Ken Tucker will be back next Wednesday at 3:30 with another edition of Hearing Secret Harmonies. And next week he'll be talking about cross-influences of rock and roll and country musics. So that's next Wednesday at 3:30. It's 4 o'clock right now. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and I want to thank Danny Miller for filling in for me during the first half of this afternoon's program. Coming up in about a half hour, I'll be speaking with painter Neil Welliver, who spends part of his time in Maine and part time in Philadelphia. He's the chair of the art department at the University of Pennsylvania, that is co-chair. And there's an exhibition of his work now on the Institute of Contemporary Art. He paints landscapes, mostly the forests in the Maine area, and we'll be talking about his work when he joins us. With me now for a return visit to Fresh Air is Paul Fussell, who's written several books of cultural history and literary criticism. He last joined us after the publication of his book Abroad, British Literary Travel Between the Wars. Fussell is also the author of The Great War and Modern Memory, which won a National Book Award. He continues to study and write about the writing and photography and art produced during the Second World War. Several essays on the subject are included in his new collection of essays, which is called The Boy Scout Handbook and Other Observations. It's published by the Oxford University Press. There are also essays included under such chapter headings as Americana, Hazards of Literature, Going Places, and Britain's Largely Eccentric. Paul Fussell is a professor of literature at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. In 1984, he'll be moving to Philadelphia to accept a position of professor at the University of Pennsylvania. After our interview, by the way, he'll be going to Sessler's bookstore for a book signing. And Sessler's is at 1308 Walnut Street, and if you'd like to see him there, he'll be there from about 4:45 to 6:30. So that's coming up later today at Sessler's bookstore. Paul Fussell, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Nice to see you again. What prompted you to pick up the new Boy Scout handbook, which leads to the title piece in your new book of essays?
Interesting question. I found it in a bookstore, of all things. I was wandering through the bookstore, and I was interested in writing something for the New Republic, which I write for. And I saw this immense stack of the official Boy Scout handbook, and I thought, good God, no literary critic has ever taken that book seriously. So I picked up a copy. It cost only $3.50. I brought it home, and I started reading it, and I was immensely impressed by it. I thought it was a very good piece of writing and philosophically very interesting, so I wrote an essay about it. And that essay became the main essay in this book.
Do you see it, that the revised handbook is being a metaphor for something?
You mean my book?
No, the revised Boy Scout handbook.
No, because they revise it every 2 or 3 years, but it's a crucial repository of wisdom. I mean, it's very important to Americans, I think, that book. As I say in this essay, I love the book, the Boy Scout Handbook. It's a very good book. I think it's a better book than about 3/4 of the books published in New York, actually, you know, annually. It's a very good book.
Well, from the way you describe it, I got the feeling that they've really gone to pains to make sure that every time they say, and make sure you go to church, they say, or synagogue.
Yes, yes, and they do that. Well, it's the Boy Scouts now is very different from the way it was when I was in it as a kid. It used to be strictly WASP and strictly white Protestant. Now it extends a very strong invitation to Jews and to blacks and so on. As I indicated in my essay, the new Boy Scout handbook, every time there's a group of kids of 4 or 5, one or two are black. And its politics are liberal to my astonishment. I assumed it was reactionary, but it's not.
some of the advice is if you're lost in the woods, prayer will help. And you write that the camper is told to carry the Bible, Testament, or prayer book of your faith. And it's interesting that when books like that update themselves and try to become relevant to more people, atheists or agnostics never seem to be included.
Well, that's true, but this is a problem with the Boy Scouts because they're saddled with Baden-Powell's 12 points of the Scout Law, and one is that a Scout is reverent. Now, if you're going to be reverent, you've got to have something to be reverent about, and that's got to be God, presumably. The point is that the Scouts, in essence, hasn't changed since about 1912 when it was made up, so it has some very old-fashioned values. But I myself, the Scout is reverent matter aside, I myself found many of these values extremely good at the moment, very refreshing, honest and useful.
Like what?
Well, like a Scout tells the truth. I mean, that's terribly good. As I indicated in my essay, out of this book you can devise exactly the reason why President Nixon was so awful, that you can say out of this book that a Scout never taps his neighbor's telephones, or a Scout never bombs and invades a neutral country and then lies about it, and so forth. You can really find out what we, even liberals and radicals, regard as right and wrong from the Boy Scout handbook. And it's valuable for that reason, I think.
Did you refer to it when you were young?
Well, I was a Scout for a while. I never got past tenderfoot, I'm afraid, the lowest rank. Yes, I think I took it very seriously, partly because I didn't believe what the church was saying very much. And I believed what came from these Scoutmasters and things who were sort of like athletic coaches. They had a lot more credit than ministers in my day. They were outdoor people and they were athletic and they were plausible. And other sources of ethical instruction didn't seem so plausible. Yeah, so I embraced this sort of Scout creed. It's actually sort of like Freemasonry for boys. It's very ethical if it takes. And if it doesn't take, you know, it's hopeless and it won't do any good. But if it takes, it's good.
Paul Fussell is my guest, and the name of his new collection of essays is The Boy Scout Handbook and Other Observations. You were also in the infantry and have written several essays and books, and I believe are working on another study now, on the Second World War and the literature it produced, the photography
yes,
taken during it. When you were in the infantry, were you able to assimilate the values of military life?
Well, I had to during the duration of the war because that was the way to survive. Everybody did that, yeah. I think I'm special because I have never gotten rid of them. I've always sort of kept them underneath and deposited them way underneath my literary learning and my philosophic learning and my political sophistication and all that. I'm still a soldier underneath. As I'm aware, even now when I wake up maybe once a week at night and, you know, I'm a soldier, and I wonder, you know, where am I? Well, I must be in a cot somewhere, a shell hole. Where's my uniform? Where's my rifle? And so on. And then suddenly I realize, no, I'm not. I'm a college professor, and I'm almost 60 years old, and the war is way back there, and it doesn't apply anymore, but it's very hard to get rid of.
Joe, I wonder how you think that's changed you.
Well, it's made me more nutty, I suppose, and more neurotic and more angry. I think I'm still deeply angry as a result of the war. As I indicated in the book, this is one reason I do so much satire as a critic. This is one reason I take so much more pleasure in finding bad writing to stigmatize than good writing to celebrate. Now, I'm still sore.
But you're angry about the war?
I'm still sore about the war, yeah, and it has to come out in some way.
You're still writing about the war. Do you think that's because you fought in it, that you remain as a literary critic interested in that period?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I don't want to let it go somehow. It tortures me, and it torments me, but I'd be lost without it. I'd lose a great deal of energy and spring and purchase on real life if I lost contact with the war. I find it very valuable. And as you said earlier on, I'm currently doing a very deep study of what I call the cultural form of the Second World War, trying to figure out the way it was accepted as meaningful by intelligent people while it was going on, how we all participated in it, what form our participation took imaginatively and emotionally.
Well, you said that the myth of the Second World War is that it was a clear-cut battle between good and evil.
Yeah, that's the way it seemed. But I think increasingly I see, if not other people, I see that it wasn't quite that simple. It's much more gray. That myth developed partly because the other side was so conspicuously wicked. There's no doubt that it was. I mean, what with the concentration camps and the Japanese murder of prisoners and so on. The other side was undeniably evil. The problem developed in imagining that therefore we were entirely good and we weren't. and we black marketed and we shot prisoners and we did terrible, terrible things which have never been admitted openly, I think. And I'm very interested in sort of restoring the grays to this situation. I don't want to take any of the blackness off the enemy. It's there, but I want to impose a little on our side and therefore make it more realistic and credible for grown-up people.
Where are you looking to find the information you need?
I'm trying to read everything written during the war in both England and the United States, and not just written in books, but written in advertisements and speeches and radio programs and musical comedies, everything. Everything involving language and the imagination. I'm trying to reinvestigate. It's a very long project. I've been on this some years now. Last year I was in England for half the year researching at the British Broadcasting Corporation, for example. And this coming year, I'm also doing research, this coming academic year. And the book is actually due at the publishers in 1988, which will give you some idea of how heavy I'm regarding it. It's a big, big job. But I want to make a serious comment about the cultural shape of the war and what it has meant to those people who were in it and who survived it.
Do you think that movies and radio broadcasts and the kind of popular inspirational music of the time had a lot to do with the creation of that myth?
Very much, yeah. The myth was almost entirely created by what we'd now recognize as advertising and publicity. Everybody during the war in this country was intensely patriotic, and therefore all elements of society cooperated in developing the myth. The myth was developed much more efficiently than in the First War because advertising and publicity and magazine production and radio were so much more effective. The war happened at the very highest moment of the age of communication, and therefore the myth could be imposed upon everybody with great efficiency. And that's what's interesting, is the efficiency with which it was all done.
Well, the Office of War Information used to, I think, send out like memos to the scriptwriters for the soap operas, for the afternoon soap operas,
entirely.
Suggesting that the characters talk about the war and
that's right.
Turning the lights off,
nothing
saving energy.
Nothing was untouched by it. Nothing was untouched. In a soap opera, a boy, for example, at some point would have to volunteer for the Marine Corps or the Army or the Navy, regardless of how plausible it might be in the dramatic situation. This was necessary. Everybody was in the war. In my generation, and I was 19 years old when the war started, in my generation, every single man friend that I knew was in the war, was in uniform, no question about it, in one service or another. And if you weren't, you were so ashamed that you had to go hide somewhere. I mean, you had to go to Wyoming and disappear until the war was over. It just wasn't tolerated that you were not somehow either in uniform or contributing to the war effort.
You've done, in one of your essays in your new book, The Boy Scout Handbook, is on the photography that was
mm-hmm.
done during the war.
Yeah.
And you talk about how in most of the photographs, and these are mostly journalistic photographs, you don't really see the faces of the men whose
This is very interesting. I think it's a convention of the photography of the time. It's partly because nobody really wants to know how awful the war is. Because if you know how awful it is, you can't really prosecute it and win it. So you've got to sort of euphemize it from yourself. Well, the best way to do it is to regard everybody who's fighting it as anonymous, more or less. They're heroic, anonymous people who might appear in a painting, but they're certainly not your neighbor next door. And he's not the guy that gets his leg blown off. It's some person that you don't know. And this is a very important convention in the photography, that you never recognize anybody's face.
Do you think it's intentional?
I think it's intentional, yeah, but, well, it's hard to say. I think it developed as an intention after the war got going. I think at first it was accidental because, as I indicate in the book, a combat photographer is very seldom in front of the troops. He's usually behind them. So what he's photographing is their backs, back of their helmets, the back of their packs, and so on. But I think once an editor receives that photographer's photographs, he says, that's what we want. That's what we want. We want imagery of sort of the common purpose with no identifiable kids. And there's nothing worse in a war than knowing the people who are fighting it. I mean, that's almost intolerable. If the high school kid is getting blown up, is your next-door neighbor, you just can't bear it. And that's one of the terrible things about the Vietnam War, that we kept seeing these faces, these black kids all the time on television. Intolerable.
One of the photographs that you include is of two Russian teenagers, I guess, who are... One is the... Well, why don't you describe it?
Yeah, well, one is a girl and one is a boy, and they're guerrillas, and they've apparently fired rifles from a distance at some German troops passing by. The Germans have stopped. They have hanged these kids immediately, and the girl is already hanging. She's dead. The boy is about to be hanged, and he's sort of avoiding looking at her body. And the fascinating thing about that picture to me, it's a picture from the Soviet authorities. These people were hanged near Minsk in the USSR. Is that the people hanging them, we would assume, are some kind of brutes or animals, but they're not. They're ordinary German, elderly German soldiers, sort of service troops who are performing this job. It's an absolutely horrifying picture. Interestingly, when I first published it and commented on it in an article in Harper's, which is collected in the book, I got very angry letters from people saying, you know, how dare you show this awful thing and so forth. And as I indicate in my rewrite of the article in my current book, I showed it because it's essential that we see those things and meditate about them. As I said now, those kids will remind us of our own children, and therefore we better, you know, if we're going to go around talking about war, we better realize what it entails. And there's no better way to do it, I think, than to look at such photographs.
It was an incredible photograph. I really felt like they were old college friends
of
mine. They look so familiar.
I felt that they were my son and daughter. Mm-hmm. And I have a girl who's at this moment about that age, and a boy who's about that age. And imagine your own children being hanged in the sort of bathrobe cord by these German soldiers. It's bizarre. Really shakes you up.
Another more famous photograph that you include is the what's it called exactly? The raising the flag at Iwo Jima.
Yes, yeah, and that's a famous photograph by Joe Rosenthal. Exactly, yeah.
Do you want to describe that one?
Well, it's a wonderful photograph. We're all so used to it that it's hard to even to recover a first feeling about it. But it's fantastic. It's as if it's been posed by a lot of athletic models. That their right legs are all bent in the same direction. They are in step. Everything they're doing with their bodies is incredibly expressive. And that's why the photograph secretly is so effective, because we recognize in it somehow, without identifying it openly, we recognize some deep artistic appeal of that picture. Although it's only about, half those guys were killed after the photograph was made, and one or two of them, you know, went mad after the war. One became a hopeless drunk. There was a movie starring Tony Curtis about that, and the whole thing ended disastrously. But for that one moment, they're sort of winning as characters in sculpture. I mean, they're redeemed for art, as it were. That's a very, very beautiful picture.
But as you point out in it, if you changed the clothes, the uniforms on the men, it could be like a Soviet propaganda poster
exactly.
Or an Italian
fascist
poster.
Nothing American about it except the flag. Yeah, I said if you change the flag to red, it becomes Soviet art because the men are all acting in concert like a committee. There's no individualism about it, which is the point. If you strip the men naked, it becomes a vainglorious work of Italian fascist sculpture that could be in white marble, you know, extremely ugly and nobody'd pay any attention to it. It somehow succeeds because it is American. I don't know why. And as I said, I think in the book that picture brings the New Deal to an end. I mean, that's the climax of sort of communal effort to get over some problem.
The other way of looking at it, though, maybe, is that to, like Soviets, it would look like American propaganda that wouldn't look much different to someone from another country as that country's kind of pro-state art with
yes, I'm sure. I'm sure. I'd love to get the Soviet view of it. I'm sure they have great deep contempt for it. They'd probably, you know, say, well, it's not posed enough. It's too informal. Now, the guys' uniforms, they differ from each other a little bit. It's not uniform enough, probably, you know, to make a committee statement or a communal statement. I've never talked to Russians about it. I'd like to.
Have you ever studied, like, the form of state art?
I've studied a lot of it. I've done a lot of it in this research I'm doing in the Second War because I'm trying to do a lot about Nazi art or what passed for it during the war, the Nazi writing and what it was and how it differed from ours and who wrote it and what's happened to them and so forth. It's almost unbelievable, the sort of garbage that was ground out in that country during the war.
Now, I know you went through all the Life Goes to War volumes.
Yes.
How does the war look as told through Time Life publications?
Well, it looks like a boy's game that we win, but only a game. It's a game. Nobody ever gets badly hurt. Or if they do, they don't suffer. They're nice, quiet bodies on a beach, and they're very still and artistic almost. And the whole dimension of the war that I know about is entirely missing from those volumes, which is people screaming at night, hoping to die, you know, and just horrible, horrible things, undescribable even today. which any literary treatment of the war, any popular photographic treatment like those Time Life volumes has to ignore entirely if they're going to be successful. Because most people can't stand that. It's too much. We spend most of our lives, after all, avoiding the knowledge of death. And nobody likes to encounter not just the knowledge of death, but an awareness of violent death and what it's like and what it betokens. There was a terrible thing during the television coverage of the Falkland Islands thing, where this was all sort of like fun and games, and the Queen Elizabeth was bringing troops, and it was all very funny, and Margaret Thatcher was saying this and that. All of a sudden, this whole thing was violated because there was a photograph of a British soldier whose leg had just been blown off, and he was on a litter being carried past us. And suddenly, the whole reality of this became clear. This wasn't about fun and games. This was about killing young men, Argentinians and Britons, who had sisters, mothers, wives, and so on, which is a part of it that almost nobody mentioned at the time, because it was all about strategy and it was about politics and so on. And so I think any encounter with war which doesn't get into those really deep, sort of fleshly matters is essentially warlike. I think pacifism or, you know, even rationality has got to focus on the things about a war that make it drastically different from peace. I mean, why, after all, am I, after, what is it now, 30-some years, still deeply affected by the Second World War, which I was only in. I mean, I was only fighting for 6 months, and many of my friends fought it for 4 years, so I got off easy. But it obviously has, in a sense, deformed my whole life, or at least directed it in a certain direction. And, you know, I still wake up shaking at night. Something like that can't just be shrugged off. And that's why I constantly come back to the subject of war in the 20th century. It fascinates me.
If you were a photography editor at a fairly mainstream journal, what would your standards be about how explicitly gory you'd let the photographs be of a war?
As explicit as possible. But then if I were a photographic editor, I'd be faced with the problem of having to satisfy a publisher. And he would have to satisfy a board of directors and so on. No, I think the way to render war is to render it very accurately. You can't do a soundtrack and do people screaming, but you can certainly show what they look like when they're wounded and so forth. And I would go just as far as possible in that direction.
Paul Fussell is my guest, and he's written extensively about the Second World Wars and is embarked on a continuation of that project now in a book that will be published in a few years. Now, his latest book is called The Boy Scout Handbook and Other Observations, and there are several essays on World War II in this collection. There's a whole genre devoted to World War II, pop histories, biographies of generals, stories of the behind-the-scenes workings of what became major battles. Do you ever read that?
Yeah, I read a lot of it. I try to read all of it, actually, because all of it is material for this
book. There's a lot of it to read.
I know it, and most of it's kind of unreal and fraudulent, but the very fact that it's unreal and fraudulent is part of the point that I need to grasp and interpret. I mean, then you have the question, why is it unreal? I mean, in whose interest is it that it be fraudulent and so on? One of the best of these, I think, was a book written by General Gavin, G-I-V-I-N. It was a parachute general in the Second War. It's one of the best American memoirs of this kind I know. I try to read a lot of that stuff. In fact, most of the time I read about the Second World War, just trying to find out more about it than I know already so I can write about it. And what I hope ultimately is to read everything written during the Second World War, both in America and England.
Well, who do you think reads those histories, the ones about the colorful generals and the major battles?
Who's written about it well?
No, who's reading it?
Who's reading it?
Because there's so many books published, I assume
somebody's
that there is
reading it. Somebody's
a sizable audience.
I'm afraid rather sick kids are reading it. And that's what I conclude. The kids who wear black leather jackets and ride Hondas, that sort of thing. I think a lot of it goes to there. There are a number of very inexpensive, sensational paperback reprints of sensational stories about the war, of adventure narratives and so on, which are sold in places where I think kids like that buy them. I don't read them because they're just, you know, I could write them better. And they're very far from any sort of factual usefulness, but they're sort of romance narrative. They're very exciting. They're full of blood and gore and guts and strenuousness and passion and so on. I think they address a male audience, which is the analog of the female audience that reads romances, you know, which are all about the sort of sex that never existed. and the women and men who never existed, who come strictly from literature. Well, these male romances about war, the heroes come from something which is not real. They come from literature as well. Bulldog Drummond is the sort of model of the hero there.
Do you know any men who fought in the war and have a nostalgia for it? Like, want to read about it to remember
those
days?
Yes, yes. I know a great many, and I get letters from them constantly. I mean, to these essays of mine about the war that I put in this book, I get maybe two or three letters a week from people who are really very nostalgic. They don't quite say this was the high point of my life, but they imply it. And they want to talk about it over and over as a way of getting back to it. They felt secure then. Somehow they were young. That's the main thing. They were under 30 when they fought the war, and now they're 60. And they desperately want to go back to the time when they were 30, regardless of the amount they suffered then.
I guess I've always found that hard to understand. I mean, I've never fought in a war.
Mm.
But the thought of war has always really both horrified and terrified mm-hmm. me. And the thought of having that be a kind of high point in your life is a concept I can't fully grasp. Do you talk with them about that when they write to you? Because it's obviously not exactly what you're getting at when you're writing.
I think I've just sort of located the secret, and that is that war is about young. War is about youth. And for men, it's a way of returning imaginatively to a moment when you were young, you were athletic, you hadn't yet made commitments, you didn't have children, you were full of promise, and so on. And I think that's really what people are talking about when they express nostalgia for the war. It's not for the war. It's for themselves when they were boys.
Did you do something to, like, extricate yourself and your writing from that context?
Well, I try to. It's very hard. It's very hard. One reason I think this is true is that I feel it myself, that one reason I'm constantly drawn back to the war is my difficulty in leaving my own youth behind. I sort of like, even though it's painful to go back to it, at least I was young then. You see, at least I hadn't already made commitments that were going to determine the shape of my life. Everything was promises and everything was open, even though the war was on. I think this is a very powerful part of the veterans' sentimental nostalgia for the war. When we find it, it's not a nostalgia for the war, it's a nostalgia for moments when we were all successful. We were all making it. We were kids, we were good-looking, we were athletic, and we hadn't been put in a mold yet. In other words, we were under 30.
So you're looking at movies now, too, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that kind of fits in with the good-evil.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We were just talking about some of the pop histories from the war, and in your collection you write that the most popular literary forms in general now are memoir, biography, and pop history.
I think so. The publishing business doesn't seem to have caught on to this yet, but it's going to, as it discovers that fewer and fewer first novels and novels of all kinds are going to be sold unless they're blockbusters. I think even the publishing trade, which is very slow to catch on to actuality, is beginning to get the point that what people really like to read are popular history, things like Len Dayton's book called Bomber and so on, and Confessions of Liddy, the Watergate guy, and people like that, and Nixon's memoirs. Those are the big sellers. And attending those, you know, are the usual standard first novels and collections of short stories, but those sell 5,000 copies. These other books sell 50,000. So I think nonfiction is our form at the moment, despite our pretensions to high art, that poetry is wonderful and fiction is wonderful. We really just give those things lip service, I think.
Why do you think that now nonfiction is as popular as it is?
God, I don't know. I think it's partly because we all sense that there's some reality in our time that we can locate, that can be disclosed, if we can find an honest deposer about it, somebody that we can really trust who will get in there, some investigative journalist, and say, look, President Nixon's a crook. Or look, blank is going on and you don't know it, or some horrible scandal's taking place. We want that. I don't know why we want it. I think it's because we all mistrust the public presentation of everything, and therefore we're drawn to books that sort of promise us some kind of disclosure, and those are nonfiction books.
I know that you spend a lot of your reading time reading fiction and nonfiction about the Second World War
Yes.
because of that study that you're working on. But when you're not reading that, Is there anything you've read lately that you've especially enjoyed, fiction or nonfiction?
Yeah, I've enjoyed, but I tend to go in for kind of outre things, I'm afraid. I greatly enjoyed a book by Eric Newby, who's hardly known in this country, called A Traveler's Life. He's a famous traveler. He's written a number of travel books. He's an Englishman. He used to be a travel editor of the British weekly, The Observer. And he's not well known here, but I take great pleasure in sort of modest books of that kind, without any great pretensions, but simply autobiographical, accurate, perceptive, tolerant, decent.
Gee, I should ask you your opinion. I don't know if you got to see any of the British-turned-PBS serialization of the Evelyn Ward novel, whose name escapes me right now.
Well, I tend to like them. The one I really prefer, I've seen The Brideshead twice.
Brideshead, yeah.
I was living in England when it was first broadcast there, and then I saw it again when I came back here. The one I really love is the dramatization of Vera Brittain's Testament of Youth, starring this brilliant British actress, Cheryl Campbell. It's really super. And by the way, this is a great moment, that production for the women's movement, because the best actress in it is this girl, Cheryl Campbell. It is directed by a woman and is written by a woman. It's superb. I recommend it to everybody. It's awfully, awfully good stuff. Testament of Youth by Vera Brittain, who was a famous nurse, feminist, and liberal during the First World War.
Did you like the Brideshead series?
Which?
Did you like the Brideshead Revisited?
Yeah, well, the Brideshead, it's made out of honey and molasses. It's a little too sweet, I thought. It's too pretty.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so very much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
I've been speaking with Paul Fussell, and we've spent a lot of this past half hour talking about his research into images of the Second World War. He's continuing his study into that, but if you want to read a book already published on that subject, The Great War and Modern Memory is one of his books, and his new collection of essays includes several essays on the Second World War. And the new book is called The Boy Scout Handbook and Other Observations, published by the Oxford University Press. And I should mention that Abroad, which is about the British literary travel writers between the two wars, has recently been published in paperback. And right now, Paul Fussell is going to be going to Sessler's Bookstore if you'd like to see him there. He'll be there till 6:30, and that's at 1308 Walnut Street in Center City, 1308 Walnut Street. And I should mention that in 1984, he'll be moving to Philadelphia to become a professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. It's 4:31, and you're tuned to 91 FM. In just a couple of minutes, my guest will be painter Neil Welliver, who now has an exhibit at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia. Trumpeter Art Farmer. It's 22 minutes to 5 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on 91 FM. The Institute of Contemporary Art at the University of Pennsylvania currently is exhibiting a retrospective of the work of painter Neil Welliver. These paintings from 1966 through 1980 are landscapes of Maine, the woods, ponds, hills, lakes, and mountains during the different seasons. Welliver has been referred to as a neo-impressionist because of his use of visible and rhythmic brushstrokes and his interest in the play of light. Welliver is the co-chair of the art department at the University of Pennsylvania. He divides his time between Maine, where he lives, and Philadelphia, where he teaches. He grew up in rural Millville, Pennsylvania, and the Institute of Contemporary Art, if you'd like to see his show, is at Walnut and 34th Streets. Neil Welliver, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Was it hard for you to find the subject matter that you wanted to paint, or did you kind of know it was going to be landscapes?
No, I think the subject matter of any painter is in some way rooted in his childhood. I had a rural childhood and spent a lot of time in the woods. I grew up near Williamsport, Pennsylvania. That country has been totally changed by expressways from the city now, and so that which I remembered as a child was no longer there. And that's how I finally went to Maine, really to try to recapture the openness and unpeopled countryside.
I wonder if you think it's very different to paint nature than it is to, say, paint houses or still lives. You can't manipulate it, really. You can change your angle.
No, painting is painting. It's really all the same. You certainly can remove the branch from a tree in a painting much easier than you can remove the leg from a person, right? So there is really a kind of flexibility.
One kind of, I guess, corny but popular sentiment is that, you know, art can't come close to the beauty already created by nature. How do you feel about sentiments like that, since you're out in nature a lot, painting it and interpreting it?
I think people see nature through art. The idea that people go out and suddenly have a fresh and totally uncluttered and undirected view of nature is absolute nonsense. They normally see it through the way they've been taught to see it, i.e. through art.
You do some portraits within the settings.
There are some figure studies and portraits in the painting. I think it hasn't been recognized at least in the press that I've heard about the show that those were done basically 15 or 16 years ago, and I've really been concentrating on the forest for a long time.
Why did you leave the figure?
I really can't give you a substantial answer for that. The figures in the case of my pictures were always a part of the environment, very strong part of it. I feel very strongly that man is part of the environment and not separate from it. And suddenly I was not very interested in the figure, and I was really painting the environment and not the figures.
Is it hard for you when you go through a period of transition where you're going to stop doing the figure? I mean, does that happen slowly?
It doesn't happen that way.
Uh-huh.
You don't decide anything in painting. It happens as you paint. Painting is not a process in which one makes intellectual decisions and then acts on them. The decisions are made as a part of the painting process.
You studied with Joseph Albers.
I studied with Joseph Albers, right.
And his painting, I mean, I know he was a color theorist, I guess you could
right.
say. And in that sense, I could see a connection with you, since you use color in a very strong way in your painting, but his paintings are so unlike yours. His paintings are like mm-hmm. squares within larger squares,
right.
and the colors contrasting in it. And yours is interpretations of nature. They're very rhythmic.
Right.
What did he teach color principles? What was it like to study?
No, he did
him?
Not teach color principles. As a matter of fact, Joseph Albers is for me was the greatest teacher of this century in the fine arts, right? People talk of Hans Hofmann and, of course, Klee and Kandinsky taught, but Albers was, for me, the great one, and I was fortunate to study with him. Albers was, on the bottom line, a poet, like we all are, want to be. And he was also German and didact, right? Just was born and reared that way, and he did a great deal of explaining and talking about what he did. In retrospect, I think now a lot of that explaining and talking was wrong, dead wrong and incorrect. I think he misused scientific terms. I think he misunderstood scientific concepts. But he had a marvelous eye, and when he was speaking in very, very simple terms, he could tell what a color was doing and what it would do in a different context. And the whole Albers thesis is that a color is only what it is because of where it is at that moment. And he loves to make red look like green and green look like red and make the colors act and interact in certain ways. And I also think, by the way, that he's an absolutely sensational painter. And I love his painting. I love to look at them.
What do you love about his paintings?
That they're such complete organisms. You know, you go and there are three or four squares and one inside of another. And if you take the time to look, which very few people do when they see three or four squares, suddenly they will move and pulse like a heartbeat and they become deep and shallow and vibrate. And they're marvelous. They're really like living organisms, simple organisms.
He had really pared down the elements of painting to very basic form and color. Was he doing that kind of work when you studied with him?
Yes.
And was it kind of against his principles to do something like a landscape painting?
No, it wasn't. When I was studying with Joseph Albers, I was a student, of course, and painting abstract pictures. And he liked my painting and also disagreed with many things I did. And when I left the school at Yale, I taught with him for a number of years, you know, for him. He attacked my work very, very strongly because I was in painting female figure, and he didn't think that was appropriate. He saw a sort of logical progression in painting and thought that it was really had become abstract and was going to go on, continue being abstract and would develop. But in fact, by that time, abstract forms were pretty well wrung out, right? But the idea that someone would again try to do something inordinately complex and so on was not part of his scenario.
You've been called a neo-impressionist. Do you feel very influenced by
Well, you know, one's called so many things. One's called so many things. Neo-impressionist, I'm a realist, but I'm also not a realist, and so on. What's the line in that funny book of Terry Southern's, The Magic Christian? Call me anything you like, but don't call me late for chow. Have you ever heard that?
No, I haven't.
You ever reading it there? So being called a neo-impressionist doesn't mean much to me, really. I'm not involved in neo-impressionism. They were involved in very systematic study of light. That's only a part of what I'm interested in.
Your paintings strike me as being very rhythmic. Is that conscious on your part? Are you interested in the rhythm of brushstrokes?
Not the rhythm of brushstrokes so much, but really certain actions occur in nature, right? And things occur at certain intervals and so on. That interests me a great deal, and I spend a lot of time observing it.
This is probably a very... the kind of question only a non-painter would ask, but when you're painting, you're like 2 inches, 3 inches away from the canvas, or a foot maybe. And your paintings are the kind of paintings where, for me as a viewer, I really wanted to stand at different distances because it kind of changes
right.
at different mm-hmm. distances. Really, how do you know how it will look and what effect you're achieving from those other distances?
There's a thing called parallel vision, and let me give you a very brief description of it. If I look at you and I don't focus, I look at your left ear with my right eye and your right ear with my left eye. I'm sort of staring. You know, you people do that when they're impolite on occasion. If you do that all day, and I do that all day, by the way, when I'm painting, visual elements take on the appearance that they would have if you were viewing them from about 8 or 10 feet when you're viewing them really at painting distance, which is a couple of feet, or 15 feet even. And sometimes, literally at the end of the day, I have a difficult time focusing again because I really paint almost all day with that unfocused thing. I do on occasion, of course, focus, right? Stop, sit down, move back, but only a few times a day. Normally I'm directly on top of the painting and it's done with that parallel vision. Don't do it at a cocktail party because people will think you're looking right through them, as they say.
Do you think it's important to be able to move around the painting and see it from those different distances?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you go, you can always tell a painter in a gallery or in a museum because they're always up with their nose in the painting and looking at it from a few feet and 10 feet and 20 feet and so on. Yes, I love the idea that people go up and look directly at my pictures and then move back and look at them from a distance.
Do you imagine your pictures in certain settings when they're
Never.
Done, like in galleries or homes?
Never. Never.
Do you follow them up and see where, like,
Never.
If someone buys it, what kind
No,
of
I'll tell you something interesting. It'll probably spoil the rest of your questions, in fact.
But we'll just end the show early. Don't
all
worry
right.
about it.
I have virtually no interest in my work when it's finished. I don't follow it. I'm a very poor careerist. I have very bad records. There was a great deal of difficulty getting this show together, in fact, because from a fire a few years ago, my records were burned, and I was careless anyway. Painting for me is a way of developing oneself, finding oneself, if you will. I don't mean that in the psychiatric sense, right? But trying to complete oneself. It's really a tool for the person to develop, to edify themselves, as they used to say. And the painting is residual. Paintings for me are really like tracks in the snow, and they're behind me. It's not my nature to look at my tracks behind me, but rather try to see where I'm going. So when a painting's finished, in effect, I'm really finished with it. Now they have economic value. I recognize that, right? They mean something economically. But the objects themselves, I have no paintings hanging in my house. Not one of my pictures hanging in my house at all.
You don't think you'd like to see it?
Well, my studio's connected with my house, and if I have paintings in the house, I'm so compulsive that the minute a painting's hanging there, I'm working on it, right? And when I'm in the house, I prefer to spend time with my children.
I am surprised that you don't go back and look at your work, because even in terms of it being edifying, I mean, if you look back over a whole body of work, you can see that much more about yourself, I'd imagine, or understand that much more about the times you've been through.
Myself is here now at this moment, right? And whatever was in the past is contained in me now, right? And to go back and review my history as a painter by looking at pictures is, to me, not a very interesting way to spend my time. I'm very interested, as we sit here, in a painting that I just left that I'm working on in Maine. I'm very interested. And I just thought about it a moment ago while we were talking.
Right? What was it like being at the Institute of Contemporary Art, where you're surrounded by your very large canvases?
I thought they were terrific.
Were you surprised?
Yeah. I was surprised, really, at the incredible change that's taken place over a period of, 15, 16 years. The early paintings are less assured, and I don't dislike them for that. The figure paintings of a good many years ago, obviously I have, I see a good deal more now and have more command of what I'm doing, but they interested me. And when one does not make an intellectual decision to change, right, but rather changes, evolves, you're not aware of the changes so much. And suddenly walk into a room and see 16 years, the residue of 16 years of your life, is kind of an interesting experience.
Huh. You don't feel changed by it in any way?
No.
Do you get anxious to finish with the painting when you start it?
Never. It never crosses my mind that I wish this painting were finished. And see, it's so difficult to tell anyone, because most people do jobs and suddenly want them finished.
You want to see how it's going to look when it's done, right?
No.
I mean, you don't, but that's...
Yes, I understand what you're saying.
Hurry.
Yes,
I
that
think
is correct.
Want to see the totality and... So mm-hmm. anxious to see what it'll
well,
look like.
You see,
like.
The totality for me is my adult life as a painter. And there's the residue of 16 years of it is over there. The painting I'm doing now is just another part of my life passing, right?
You know, a lot of musicians don't spend much time listening to music because they spend so much time making it and listening
right.
to what they're making. And since your subject matter is nature, do you ever want to get away from that so that you're not thinking in compositional terms, since you're always...
Well, I'll tell you a very interesting thing. There are two places in the world I absolutely love. One is Maine, and the forest, where I spend a great deal of time, even when I'm not painting, just ambling, rambling through the woods, smelling, looking. And the other place is New York City.
What about New York?
Well, you know, Rudy Burkhardt said a marvelous thing to me one time. We were walking in Maine, and he's very laconic, and he said, "You know, Neil, Maine is exactly like New York City." And I said, "Oh, very interesting. How's that, Rudy?" And he said, "Well, in Maine, when you walk in the woods, there's always something different. And in New York, when you walk in the streets, there's always something different."
Can't argue that.
Yeah. So I love New York. I love the people. I like all the things that people don't like about New York. I like the noise. I like the people. I like the culture. I love it.
And the people I'm sorry.
I love Maine because they both have very, very high style, you know, the country and, I mean, the real country and the city.
I think the people who don't like New York say that you like it only because you're not there enough to hate it.
Oh, no. I spend a lot of time there. I spend all the time I can. You know, whenever it's convenient and I'm not working, I want to go somewhere, I go to New York.
Could you see yourself painting New York landscapes, urban landscapes?
No. No, I couldn't because I'm not rooted in that. Right? I see Philip Perlstein's New York landscapes. I think they're terrific. Jane Freilicher's, I think they're marvelous, right? I'm not rooted in it.
Can I ask you what you think of Richard Estes's work?
I like it. I like it very much. Yeah. I think he's a really accomplished artist.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No. There has been a kind of new realism,
and
there have been shows about the new realist. Has that kind of new realism boom been affecting the way your work is viewed, or the interest of galleries or buyers in your work?
I'm considered, or has been written, numerous times, that I'm one of the sort of prototypes of that movement. You know, myself and Alex Katz and Philip Perlstein, the people that are in their early 50s, and so on. And there's another whole generation that comes along. Sure. That affects the way my work's received, and very positively.
Is that a label that you're comfortable with?
No. It's not a label I'm comfortable with. I do not frankly feel a part of the realist movement, you know.
I wonder if anybody does.
I don't know. That may be the nicest thing about it, is that it's so broad and so inclusive. You know, Frank Goodyear did the realist show here and got some bad press for it, you know. I thought that was one of the most marvelous shows done in this country in years and years and years, because it was so broad and it showed the incredible range of sense data painting.
In addition to your work as a painter, and I should remind our listeners that my guest is Neil Welliver, you're also the co-chair of the art department at Penn. And with being the chairman of any department comes not only the teaching duties, but the administrative responsibilities, which I would think for you as a painter might be very, very trying or tedious. How do you handle that aspect of your work?
Well, there's a woman named Mary Beth Phillips and a woman named Lisa Allen, both of whom are absolutely incredible managers, and they work there in that department, and they manage a great many of the things that some chairmen have to do for me. And since I trust them implicitly, I don't have to worry about that. My feeling is that in a graduate department of that kind, one of the most important things is the selection of people who are going to deal with the students. And I see that as a primary function. And anyway, schools are over-administered. Everyone knows that. I mean, there are thousands of meetings that people are requested to go to behind which executive decisions are made. So we just don't do that. It's pretty straightforward.
Do your students or their interests surprise you?
I don't understand the question. I don't recognize the question. Does what?
Do your students or their interests or their interest in painting and art surprise you? The kind of work they're turning out.
No, it's on a very high level, and it doesn't surprise me. I think it's delightful.
I mean, the interest even in the style or the conceptual interest that they bring to their painting.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not surprised by it. I anticipate it. I mean, I expect it.
You said before that for you, painting isn't an intellectual experience. There isn't that sense of planning and deciding what you'll be interested in. So that probably preempts this question, but do you think you'll ever exhaust the subject of Maine Forest, or can you see yourself painting that for many more years?
No, let me first correct what you said.
Sure,
I think maybe I didn't make myself clear. There is a very, very large intellectual part to painting, right? What I'm saying is that the decision-making is also locked into the making, right? It's not separate and free of it. Secondly, no, every time I walk in the forest in Maine, I find something that I've never seen. In places that I've walked through 100 times, suddenly it appears absolutely differently. I see something absolutely... I can't imagine living that long.
Well, I will continue to enjoy your work, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Neil Welliver has been my guest, and there's a exhibit of his work now on display at the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Penn campus, and it's his landscape paintings of Maine. It covers about 14 years, and the Institute of Contemporary Art is on 34th and Walnut Streets. Neil Welliver is also the co-chair of the University of Pennsylvania Art Department. He lives in Maine and also, of course, commutes to Philadelphia to teach. It's 2:30 to 5:00, and we'll be joining National Public Radio for All Things Considered at 5. Let me tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. At 2:00, we'll broadcast tape delayed Senator Paul Tsongas of Massachusetts' appearance before the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and he'll be speaking on the prospects for Democrats in the upcoming elections. So that's tomorrow at 2, National Press Club appearance with Senator Paul Tsongas. At about 3:00, we'll be joined by Dr. Stephen Langer, a co-founder of the American Nutritional Medical Association. This is a new group that's trying to establish standards for the sale of natural foods and health food products. At 3:30, Francis Davison Interval, our weekly review of new jazz releases. And at 4:00, WUHY station manager Bill Seemring will be with us. He joins us once a month, talks about special programs, program schedule changes, and then we open up the telephones and invite you to call with any questions or comments that you have about our programming that you'd like to discuss with Bill. So you'll be invited to call tomorrow at 4, and I hope you can join us then. Ken Tucker contributed to this afternoon's Fresh Air. Danny Miller hosted the first half. Rob Richards was the technical director. Danny Miller's the associate producer of the show. Maeve McGoor and the production assistant. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening. Wish you a very good evening. Thank you. is WUHY FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Support for this program comes from the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for Midwestern coverage, the Joyce Foundation, the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues, and RKO General, a radio and television broadcasting company. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
In 15 years, the high school and college students who are experimenting with LSD will be running many of our institutions and guiding public policy. They're your best educated, your most creative, and your most courageous young people. And like it or not, they're going to build you a new civilization.
A failed prophecy from the late 60s and Timothy Leary. He and many others believed for a time that the world could change. And perhaps it did for a time. Tonight on All Things Considered, 1967, the Summer of Love.
And these stories, a shouting match at the White House, President Reagan meeting with Republican congressional candidates, gets criticism from one of his own.
Johnson & Johnson stock creeps back up after the Tylenol crisis.
Aspirin and pregnancy, new warnings for women.
An evacuation exercise in Connecticut is a disaster.
Soviet killer satellites, disastrous for global politics, according to one expert.
Then some things for better living.
Apple cider in Vermont.
And a shower in a can.
That and more on All Things Considered. First, this roundup of the news.
This is John Hockenberry. A Wall Street rally shot stock prices through the roof today. The Dow Jones Industrial scored their second biggest gain ever, up more than 37 points. 93 million shares were traded, the eighth biggest volume in history. A composite average of 65 stocks on the New York Exchange was up more than 11 points. An average share on Wall Street rose a whopping 88 cents. Analysts seem surprised by the surge, unable to pin it on any economic news. But many large blocks of securities were traded, a sign that institutional investors as a whole are encouraged by the investment climate. It was supposed to be a pep talk for 74 Republican candidates in the East Room of the White House, but it proved to be a battle of the conservatives. Conservative GOP candidate Gary Arnold from California stood up while President Reagan was chairing the meeting, and he began to assail the Reagan administration for abandoning conservative thinking in economic and foreign policy. The meeting quickly became a shouting match between Arnold and the president, and later Arnold told reporters that the president has gone soft.
We're being led around like little liberal lemmings, sitting there being told these different statistics. We came out of a meeting over there in which we're pushing a bill that was sponsored by Augustus Hawkins and John F. Kennedy, or Edward Kennedy, as the answer of how we're going to supply jobs. Reagan has gone Keynesian.
Arnold said the administration has funneled money to Panama and Poland from that arch-nemesis of ultra-conservatives, the Trilateral Commission. President Reagan became so irritated at Arnold's tirade in the East Room that at one point he told him to, quote, shut up. President Reagan and his advisors met for an hour today with Philip Habib, the man who negotiated the PLO withdrawal from Beirut. Habib said afterwards that no timetable has yet been set for the withdrawal of Israeli, Syrian, and those Palestinian forces still in Lebanon. But he said one way or another, that problem must be worked out.
Our position remains that it should be done as quickly as possible. There's no question about that.